As a result, the loyal Tsardaukar were spread too thinly, and because of the costly Project Amal, the imperial treasury had insufficient funds to train and supply new troops. Thus, the military reserves were being depleted, and Fenring saw troubled times ahead. As House Moritani's actions proved, some forces in the Landsrad sensed weakness, smelled blood. Fenring considered reminding Shaddam of all this, but instead he held his own counsel as the meeting continued. His old friend seemed to think he could handle things without him. So, let the man prove it. The Emperor would get himself deeper and deeper into trouble, and finally he would have to call his exiled spice minister back to Kaitain. When that occurred, Fenring would make him grovel, before finally assenting. Organizational structure is crucial to the success of a movement. It is, as well, a prime target for attack. Kamar Pilru, Ixian Ambassador in Exile, Treatise on the Downfall of Unjust Governments. Before the next meeting of the resistance group, Kater disguised himself as an introverted suboid worker. Under the guise, he spent days of reconnaissance in the underground warrens where the rebels planned to gather. Interspersed with islands of stalactite buildings, the hollow projected sky looked wrong, mimicking light from a sun that did not belong to Ix. Kater's arms ached from placing heavy crates on self-motivated pallets that delivered supplies, equipment, and raw materials into the sealed-off research pavilion. The invaders had commandeered a cluster of industrial facilities and modified the construction, building over rooftops and connecting side passages. Under House Vernius, the facilities had been masterfully designed to be both beautiful and functional. Now they resembled rodent nests, all sloping barricades and armored gables that shimmered beneath defensive fields. Their covered windows looked like blind eyes. What are the Tleilaxu doing in there? Kater wore drab clothes, let his face hang slack and his eyes grow dull. He focused on the tedious monotony of his tasks. When dust or dirt smudged his cheeks, when grease smeared his fingers, he did nothing to clean himself, just plodded like clockwork. Although the Tleilaxu did not consider suboids worthy of attention, the invaders had rallied these workers during their takeover of Ix. Despite promises of better conditions and better treatment, the Tleilaxu had ground the suboids under their heels, far more than their experiences under Dominic Vernius. When he was off shift, Kater lived in a rock-walled chamber within the suboid warrens. The workers had little social life, did not speak much to each other. Few noticed the newcomer or asked his name. None of them made overtures of friendship. He felt more invisible there than when he had hidden in a shielded chamber for months during the initial revolt. Kater preferred being invisible. He could accomplish more that way. Slipping off by himself, he evaluated the secret meeting place beforehand. He took bootleg equipment into the empty supply chamber to scan for surveillance instruments. He did not dare underestimate the Tleilaxu, especially since two more legions of Imperial Tsardaukar had been stationed here to keep even tighter control. He stood in the center of the chamber and turned in a slow circle, concerned about the five tunnels leading into the chamber. Too many entrances, too many spots for an ambush. He pondered for a moment, then smiled as an idea occurred to him. The following afternoon he stole a small holo projector, with which he imaged comparable featureless rock. Moving silently, he set up the projector inside one of the openings and switched it on. A false barrier of rock now blocked one of the tunnels, a perfect illusion. Kater had lived with suspicion and fear for so long that he never expected his plans to go well. But that didn't mean he stopped hoping. The freedom fighters arrived one by one as the appointed time approached. No one risked traveling with any other rebel. Each wore a disguise. Each came prepared with an excuse for his business down in the subway tunnels. Kater arrived late. Safely late. The furtive resistance fighters exchanged vital equipment and discussed plans in harsh whispers. No one had an overall strategy. Some of their schemes were so impossible, Kater had to force himself not to laugh, while others seemed like suggestions he might want to imitate. He needed more crystalline rods for his Rogo transmitter. After each attempt to communicate with his distant navigator brother, the crystals splintered and cracked, leaving him with pounding headaches. The last time he'd tried the Rogo, Kater had been unable to contact Demur. Sensing his twin's presence and a few staticky thoughts, but without linking up. Afterward, lying awake for hours in his darkened chamber, Kater felt lost and depressed, entirely alone. He realized just how much he had counted on his brother's well-being, and on hearing that others from Ix had escaped and survived. At times, Kater wondered exactly what he had accomplished in all his years of struggle. He wanted to do more, wanted to strike forcefully against the Tleilaxu. But what could he do? He stared at the gathered rebels, people who talked a great deal but accomplished little. He watched their faces, noting greed in the black marketeers and ferret-like nervousness in others. Kater wondered if these were truly the allies he needed. Somehow he doubted it. Miral Alekum was also there, bartering furiously for more components to add to her mysterious plan. She seemed different from the others, willing to take necessary action. Unobtrusively, he worked his way over to Miral and caught the gaze of her large, wary eyes. "I've studied the components you buy." He nodded toward the few items she held in her hands. "And I can't fathom your plan. I might be able to help. I've done a good deal of tinkering myself." She took a half step back, like a suspicious rabbit, trying to read the meaning behind his words. Finally, she spoke through pale lips, but her mouth remained drawn.
"I have an idea. I need to search."
Before she could continue, Kater heard a movement in the tunnels, footsteps that were at first faint and then louder. The lookout guards shouted. One ducked inside the room as projectile gunfire rang out. "We're betrayed!" shouted one of the rebels. In the confusion, Kater saw Sardaukar soldiers and Tleilaxu warriors converging from the four exits, blocking the tunnels. They fired into the gathered resistance fighters as if it were a shooting gallery. Screams, smoke, and blood filled the air. Sardaukar hurried in with hand weapons drawn. Some used only their fists and fingers to kill. Kater waited for the smoke to thicken, for the rebels to fly into a greater frenzy, and then lunged forward. Seeing no escape, Miral crouched low. Kater grabbed her by the shoulders. She began to fight him, thrashing as if he were her enemy. But Kater pushed her backward toward the solid rock wall. She fell directly through. He plunged after her into the hollow-covered opening. He felt a twinge of guilt for not shouting to the others. But if all the rebels disappeared through the same escape hatch, the Sardaukar would be upon them in moments. Miral looked around in confusion. Kater grabbed her arm and dragged her along. "I planned for an escape ahead of time. A hologram." They began sprinting through the tunnel. Miral stumbled beside him.
"Our group is dead."
"It was never my group," Kater said, panting. "They're amateurs." She looked at him as they ran, her dark eyes boring into his.
We must separate.
He nodded, then both took divergent tunnels. Far behind him, he heard the Sardaukar cry out as they discovered the disguised opening. Gutter ran faster, taking a left tunnel, then an uphill branch, doubling back to a different grotto. Finally, he reached a lift tube that would take him out into the immense cavern. Like a subboid going to work on the late shift, he fumbled for one of his identity cards and swiped it through a reader. The lift tube whisked him toward the stalactite buildings that had once been inhabited by bureaucrats and nobles who served House Vernius. Within the ceiling levels, he raced across connecting walkways, slipped between buildings, and looked down at the glittering lights of corrupted manufactories. Finally, inside the crustal levels of what had once been the Grand Palais, he made his way to the shielded bolt hole he had abandoned long ago. He slipped to the chamber and locked it. He hadn't found it necessary to hide there for a long time, but tonight he'd come closer to capture than ever before. In the silent darkness, Gutter rolled onto the musty-smelling cot that had been his bed for so many tense evenings. Panting, he stared at the low ceiling, black above him. His heart pounded. He could not relax. He imagined seeing stars above his room, a blizzard of tiny lights that showered across the open night sky on Ix's pristine surface. As his thoughts traveled out into the sprawling expanse of the galaxy, he envisioned Demur flying his guild ship, safely away from here. Gutter had to contact him soon. The universe is our picture. Only the immature imagine the cosmos to be what they think it is. Sagan Vaisi, First Head Instructor, Guild Navigator School. Demur, a voice said in the back of his awareness. Demur. Within the sealed navigation chamber atop his highliner, Demur swam in spice gas, kicking his webbed feet. Orange eddies swirled around him. In his navigation trance, all star systems and planets were a grand tapestry, and he could travel along any thread he chose. He derived supreme pleasure from entering the womb of the universe and conquering its mysteries. It was so peaceful in deep, open space. The brightness of suns came and went. A vast, eternal night dotted with tiny points of illumination. Demur performed the higher-order mental calculations required to foresee a safe course through any star system. He guided the immense ship through the limitless void. He could encompass the reaches of the universe and transport passengers and freight to any place he desired. He saw the future and conformed to it. Because of the outstanding abilities he had demonstrated, Demur was among only a few mutated humans who had risen through the navigator's ranks so swiftly. Human. The word was little more than a lingering memory for him. His emotions, strange detritus from his original physical form, swung him in a way he had not expected. In the 17 standard years he'd spent growing up on Ix with his twin brother Kater, he had not possessed the time, wisdom, or desire to understand what it meant to be human. And for the past dozen years, admittedly by his own choice, he'd been removed from that dubious reality and vaulted into another existence, part dream, part nightmare. Certainly his new appearance could frighten any man who was unprepared for the sight. But the advantages, the reasons he had joined the guild in the first place, more than compensated for that. He experienced cosmic beauty unknown to other life forms. What they could only imagine, he actually knew. Why had the Spacing Guild accepted him at all? Very few outsiders were admitted to the elite corps. The Guild favored their own navigator candidates, those born in space to Guild employees and loyalists, some of whom had never walked upon solid ground. Am I only an experiment? A freak among freaks? Sometimes, with all the contemplative time on a great voyage, Demur's mind wandered. Am I being tested at this very moment by some means that can scan my aberrant thoughts? Whenever the wild awareness of his previous human self came over him, Demur felt as if he were standing on the edge of a precipice, deciding whether or not to leap into the void. The Guild is always watching. While floating in the navigation chamber, he journeyed among the remnants of his emotions. An unusual sense of melancholy enveloped him. He had sacrificed so much to become what he was. He could never land on any planet unless he emerged in a wheeled and enclosed tank of spice gas. He concentrated hard, drove his thoughts back into line. If he allowed the human self to become too strong, Demur might send the Highliner reeling off course. "Demur," the nagging voice said again, like the throbbing pain of a mounting headache. "Demur." He ignored it. He tried to convince himself that such thoughts and regrets must be common for navigators, that others experienced them as often as he did. But why hadn't the instructors warned him? "I am strong. I can overcome this." On a routine flight to the Bene Gesserit world of Wallach 9, he piloted one of the last Highliners constructed by Ixians, before the Tleilaxu took over and reverted to an earlier, less efficient design. Mentally, he reviewed the passenger list, seeing the words imaged on the walls of his navigation tank. A Duke was aboard, Leto Atreides, and his friend Romber Vernius, exiled heir to the lost fortunes of Ix. Familiar faces and memories. A lifetime ago, Demur had been introduced to young Leto in the Grand Palais. Navigators overheard snippets of Imperial news and could eavesdrop on business conducted over the communication channels, but they paid little attention to petty matters. This Duke had won a trial by forfeiture, a monumental act that had granted him respect throughout the Imperium. Why would Duke Leto be going to Wallach 9? And why did he bring the Ixian refugee? The distant, crackling voice cut in again. "Demur, answer me." With sudden clarity, he realized it was a manifestation of his former life. Loyal, kind Kater attempting to stay in touch, though for months Demur had been unable to reply. Perhaps it was a distortion caused by the continuing evolution of his brain, widening the gulf between himself and his brother. The atrophied vocal cords of a navigator could still utter words, but the mouth was primarily used to consume more and more melange. The mind expansion of the spice trance pushed away Demur's former life and contacts. He could no longer experience love, except as a flickering memory. He could never again touch a human being. With one of his stubby, webbed hands, he withdrew a concentrated melange pill from a container and popped it into his tiny mouth, increasing the flow of spice through his system. His mind floated a little, but not enough to dull the pain of the past, and of the attempted mental contact. This time his emotions were too strong to overcome. His brother finally stopped calling to him, but he would return soon. He always did. Now the only sound Demur heard was the steady hiss of gas entering the chamber. Melange. Melange. It continued to pour into him, filling his senses completely. He had no individuality left, could barely tolerate speaking to his own brother anymore. He could only listen and remember. War is a form of organic behavior. The army is a means of survival for the all-male group. The all-female group, on the other hand, is traditionally religion-oriented. They are the keepers of sacred mysteries. Bene Gesserit teaching. After descending from the orbiting highliner and passing through the intricate atmospheric defensive systems, Duke Leto Atreides and Romber Vernius were met in the mother school's spaceport by a contingent of 3 black-robed women. Wallach 9's blue-white sun was not visible from the ground. A bone-chilling breeze whipped into the open-air portico where the group stood. Leto felt it through his clothing and could see white feathers of breath curl from his exhalations. At his side, Romber pulled the collar of his jacket tight. The leader of the escort committee introduced herself as Mother Superior Harishka, an honor Leto had not expected. What have I ever done to warrant such attention? When he'd been imprisoned on Kaitain, awaiting his trial by forfeiture, the Bene Gesserit had secretly offered him assistance, but had never explained their reasons. The Bene Gesserit do nothing without a clear purpose. Old but energetic, Harishka had dark almond eyes and a direct manner of speaking. Prince Romber Vernius. She bowed to the round-faced young man, who swept his purple and copper cape in a dashing gesture of his own. It is a pity what happened to your great house, a terrible pity. Even the sisterhood finds the Bene Tlelax incomprehensible. Thank you, but I am certain everything will work out. Just the other day our ambassador in exile submitted another petition to the Landsrad Council. He smiled with forced optimism. I seek no sympathy. You seek only a concubine, correct? The old woman turned to lead the way out of the portico and onto the grounds of the mother school complex. We welcome the opportunity to place one of our sisters in Castle Caladan. I am sure she will benefit you and the Atreides. They followed a cobblestone pathway between interlinked stucco buildings with terracotta roof tiles, arranged like the scales on a reef lizard. In a flower-filled courtyard, they paused at a stylized black quartz statue of a woman kneeling. The founder of our ancient school, Harishka said, Rakela Berto Anirul. By manipulating her own body chemistry, Rakela survived what would have been a lethal poisoning. Romber bent to read the brass plaque. It says that all written and pictorial records of this woman were lost long ago when invaders set fire to the library building and destroyed the original statue. How do you know what she looked like? With a wrinkled smile, Harishka said cryptically, Why, because we are witches. Without another word, the robed old woman led the way down a short stairway and through a humid greenhouse, where acolytes and sisters tended exotic plants and herbs. Perhaps medicines, perhaps even poisons. The mother school was a place of legend and mythology, seen by few men, and Leto had been astonished at the warm acceptance that his brash request had received. He had asked the Bene Gesserit to select a talented, intelligent mate for Romber, and his tousle-haired friend had agreed to go shopping. At a brisk pace, Harishka crossed a grassy field where women in short, lightweight robes performed impossible stretching exercises to a vocal cadence called out by a wrinkled, stooped old woman, who matched them move for move. Leto found their bodily control astonishing. When they finally entered a large stucco building with dark timbered beams and highly polished wooden floors, Leto was glad to be out of the sharp wind. The building had a dusty chalkboard smell from old plaster walls. The foyer opened into a practice hall, where a dozen young women in white robes stood motionless in the center, as erect as soldiers waiting for inspection. Their hoods were thrown back over their shoulders. Mother Superior stopped in front of the acolytes. The two reverend mothers accompanying her went to stand behind the young women. "Who here seeks a concubine?" Harishka inquired. It was a traditional question, part of the ritual. Romber stepped forward. "I do. Prince Romber, firstborn son and heir of House Vernius. Or perhaps I seek even a wife." He glanced over at Leto and lowered his voice. "Since my house is renegade, I don't have to play silly political games. Unlike some people I know." Leto flushed, remembering the lessons his father had taught him. "Find love wherever you like, but never marry for love. Your title belongs to House Atreides. Use it to strike the best possible bargain." He had recently traveled to Forested Ekaz to meet with Archduke Armand in his provisional capital after the Mauritani carpet bombing of his ancestral chateau. Under the Emperor's crackdown, sending a legion of Sardaukar to Grumman to keep the fuming Viscount at bay, open hostilities between the two houses had stopped, at least for the moment. Archduke Armand Ekaz had requested an investigation team to study the alleged sabotage of the famous Ekazi fog tree forests and other crops, but Shaddam had refused. "Let sleeping dogs lie," had been his official imperial response, and he expected the problem to end there. Recognizing Leto's diligent attempts to calm the still uneasy tensions, the Archduke had informally mentioned that his eldest daughter, Sanya, might be a marriageable prospect for House Atreides. Upon hearing the suggestion, Leto had considered the assets of House Ekaz, their commercial, political, and military power, and how they might complement the resources of Caladan. He had not even looked at the girl in question. "Study the political advantages of a marriage alliance." His father would have been pleased. "Now," Mother Superior said, "these young women are well trained in the myriad ways of pleasing nobility. All have been chosen according to your profile, Prince." Romber approached the line of women and looked closely at each of their faces. Blondes, brunettes, redheads, some with skin as pale as milk, some as sleek and dark as ebony. All were beautiful, all intelligent, and all studied him with poise and anticipation. Knowing his friend as he did, Leto was not surprised to see Romber pause in front of a rather plain-looking girl with wide-set sepia eyes and mousy brown hair cut as short as a man's. She met Romber's appraisal without looking away, without feigning a demure reaction as some of the others had done. Leto noted the faintest smile curving her lips upward. "Her name is Tessia," the Mother Superior said. "A very intelligent, talented young woman. She can recite the ancient classics perfectly, and plays several musical instruments." Romber tilted her chin up, looked into her dark brown eyes. "But can you laugh at a joke? And tell an even better one in return?" "Clever wordplay, my lord," Tessia answered. "Do you prefer a distressingly bad pun, or a joke so bawdy it'll make your cheeks burn?" Romber guffawed with delight. "This one!" As he touched Tessia's arm, she stepped out of line and walked with him for the first time. Leto was pleased to see his friend so happy, but his heart was heavy as well, considering his own lack of a relationship. Romber often did things on impulse, but had the fortitude to make them turn out right. "Come here, children," Harishka said in a solemn tone. "Stand before me and bow your heads." They did so, holding hands. With a paternal frown, Leto stepped forward to straighten Romber's collar and brushed an offending wrinkle from his shoulder pad. The Ixian prince flushed, then mumbled his thanks. Arishka continued. May you both lead long, productive lives and enjoy each other's honorable company. You are now bound. If, in years to come, you should choose to marry and seal the bond beyond concubinage, you have the blessings of the Bene Gesserit. If you are not satisfied with Tessia, she may return here to the mother school. Leto was surprised to witness so many ceremonial trappings in what was fundamentally a business agreement. By courier from Caladan, he had already agreed upon a range of prices. Still, Mother Superior's words imbued the relationship with some structure and established a foundation for good things to come. Prince Romber, this is a special woman, trained in ways that may surprise you. Heed her advice, for Tessia is wise beyond her years. Mother Superior stepped back. Tessia leaned forward to whisper in Romber's ear, and the exiled prince laughed. Looking at his friend, he said, Tessia has an interesting idea. Leto, why don't you select a concubine for yourself? There's plenty to choose from. He gestured toward the other acolytes. That way you won't have to keep making eyes at my sister. Leto blushed furiously. His long-standing attraction to Kylea must be obvious, though he had taken steps over the years to conceal it. He had refused to take her to his bed, torn as he was by the demands of ducal duty and the admonitions of his father. I've had other lovers, Romber, you know that. City and village girls find their duke attractive enough. There's no shame in it, and I can maintain my honor with your sister. Romber rolled his eyes. So, some fisherman's daughter from the docks is good enough for you, but my sister isn't? That's not it at all. I do this out of respect for House Vernius and for you. Arishka broke in. I am afraid the women we have brought here are not suitable for Duke Atreides. These have been selected for compatibility with Prince Romber. Her prunish lips smiled. Nonetheless, other arrangements might be made. She glanced up at an interior balcony, as if someone were watching them in concealment from above. I am not here for a concubine, Leto said gruffly. He's the independent sort, Romber said to Mother Superior, then raised his eyebrows at Tessia. What are we to do with him? He knows what he wants, but does not know to admit it to himself, Tessia said with a clever smile. A bad habit for a duke. Romber patted Leto on the back. See, she's already giving good advice. Why don't you just take Kylea as your concubine and be done with it, Leto? I'm growing tired of your schoolboy angst. It's certainly within your rights, and we both know it's the best she can aspire to be. With an uneasy laugh, Leto dismissed the idea, though he had considered it many times. He had been hesitant to approach Kylea with such a suggestion. What might her reaction be? Would she demand to be more than a concubine? That was impossible. Still, Romber's sister understood political realities. Before the Ixian tragedy, the daughter of Earl Vernius would have been an acceptable match for a duke. Perhaps that's what old Paulus had had in mind. But now, as head of House Atreides, Leto could never marry into a family that no longer held any imperial title or fief. What is this love that so many speak of with such apparent familiarity? Do they truly comprehend how unattainable it is? Are there not as many definitions of love as there are stars in the universe? The Bene Gesserit Question Book. From an interior balcony overlooking the waiting acolytes, 12-year-old Jessica watched the concubine selection process with intent eyes and sharp curiosity. Standing beside the girl, Reverend Mother Mohiam had instructed her to observe. So Jessica drank in every detail with practiced Bene Gesserit scrutiny. What does the teacher want me to see? On the polished hardwood floor, Mother Superior stood talking with the young nobleman and his newly selected concubine, Tessia Al-Ryle. Jessica had not predicted that choice. Several of the other acolytes were more beautiful, more shapely, more glamorous. But Jessica did not know the prince or his personality, was not familiar with his tastes. Did beauty intimidate him? An indication of low self-esteem? Perchance the acolyte Tessia reminded him of someone else he had known. Or maybe he was simply attracted to her for some difficult-to-define reason. Her smile, her eyes, her laugh. Never try to understand love, Mohiam cautioned in a directed whisper, sensing the girl's thoughts. Simply work to understand its effects in lesser people. Below, one of the other reverend mothers brought a document on a writing board and handed it to the prince for his signature. His companion, a black-haired, hawk-featured nobleman, peered over his shoulder to review the fine print. Jessica could not make out their spoken words, but she was familiar with the ancient ritual of duty. The dark-haired duke reached forward to fix his companion's collar. She found the gesture oddly endearing, and she smiled. "Will I be presented to a nobleman one day, Reverend Mother?" she whispered. No one had ever explained what Jessica's purpose in the Bene Gesserit might be, and it was a constant source of curiosity to her, one that often irritated Mohiam. The Reverend Mother formed a scowl on her plain, aging face, as Jessica had suspected she would. "When the time is right, you will know, child. Wisdom is understanding when to ask questions." Jessica had heard this admonition before. "Yes, Reverend Mother, impatience is a weakness." The Bene Gesserit had many such sayings, all of which Jessica had committed to memory. She sighed in exasperation, then controlled the reaction, hoping her teacher had not seen. The sisterhood obviously had some plan for her. Why wouldn't they reveal her future? Most other acolytes had some idea of their predetermined paths, but Jessica saw only a blank wall ahead of her, with no writing on it. "I am being groomed for something, prepared for an important assignment." Why had her teacher brought her to this balcony, at this precise moment? There was no accident in this, no coincidence. The Bene Gesserit planned everything, thought everything through with utmost care. "There is hope for you yet, child," Mohiam murmured. "I instructed you to observe, but you are intent on the wrong person. Not the man with Tessia. Watch the other one. Watch them both. Watch how they interact with each other. Tell me what you see." From her high vantage, Jessica studied the men. She breathed deeply, let her muscles relax. Her thoughts, like minerals suspended in a glass of water, clarified. "Both men are nobles, but not blood kin, judging from differences in their dress, mannerisms, and expressions." She did not take her eyes from them. "They have been close friends for many years. They depend on one another. The black-haired one is concerned for his friend's welfare." "And?" Jessica heard excitement and anticipation in her teacher's voice, though she could not imagine why. The Reverend Mother's eyes were riveted on the second nobleman. "I can tell by his bearing and interaction that the dark-haired one is a leader and takes his responsibility seriously. He has power but does not wallow in it. He is probably a better ruler than he gives himself credit for." She watched his movement, the flush of his skin, the way he looked at the other acolytes, and then forced himself to turn away.
He is also lonely.
Excellent. Mohiam beamed down at her pupil, but her eyes narrowed. That man is Duke Leto Atreides, and you are destined for him, Jessica. One day you will be the mother of his children. Though Jessica knew she should take this news impassively, as a duty she must perform for the sisterhood, she suddenly found a need to calm her hammering heart. At that moment, Duke Leto glanced up at Jessica, as if sensing her presence in the balcony shadows, and their gazes met. She saw a fire in his gray eyes, a strength and wisdom beyond his years, the result of bearing difficult burdens. She felt herself drawn to him. But she resisted. Instincts, automatic reactions, responses. I am not an animal. She rejected other emotions, as Mohiam had taught her for years. Jessica's previous questions vanished, and for the moment she formed no new ones. A deep, calming breath brought her to a state of serenity. For whatever reasons, she liked the look of this duke. But her duty was to the sisterhood. She would wait to learn what lay in store for her, and she would do whatever was necessary. Impatience is a weakness. Inwardly, Mohiam smiled. Knowing the genetic threads she'd been ordered to weave, the Reverend Mother had staged this brief but distant encounter between Jessica and Duke Atreides. Jessica was the culmination of many generations of careful breeding to create the Kwisatz Haderach. The mistress of the program, Kwisatz Mother Anirul, wife of Emperor Shaddam, claimed that the highest likelihood of success would occur if a Harkonnen daughter of the current generation produced an Atreides daughter. Jessica's secret father was Baron Harkonnen, and when she was ready, she would be joined with Duke Leto Atreides. Mohiam found it supremely ironic that these mortal enemies, House Harkonnen and House Atreides, were destined to form such an incredibly important union, one that neither house would ever suspect or condone. She could hardly restrain her excitement at the prospect. Thanks to Jessica, the sisterhood was only two generations away from its ultimate goal. When you ask a question, do you truly want to know the answer, or are you merely flaunting your power? Dmitri Harkonnen, Notes to My Sons. Baron Harkonnen had to pay for the Souk doctor twice. He'd thought his massive payment to Richesian Premier Kalamar would be sufficient to obtain the services of Dr. Wellington Yue for as long as would be required to diagnose and treat his debilitating illness. Yue, though, refused to cooperate. The sallow Souk doctor was totally absorbed in himself and his technical research on the orbiting laboratory moon of Corona.